Hello.
Hi, may I speak to Henry, please?
Yeah, that's me.
Hi, Henry. This is Matt Levin from Madison, Wisconsin.
Right on time. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Not too bad.
Great. Well, thanks again for agreeing to talk with me over the phone and making time.
Okay. Let's hope it's useful.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. Maybe we can just start off by you telling me a little bit how you ended up in Madison, Wisconsin. And I know you were from somewhere in New York City,
Brooklyn area,
right? Brooklyn.
Right.
How'd you end up in Madison?
And I was one of the Ford Fellows.
Okay.
So you're familiar with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Ford Foundation, right?
I can tell you how Madison, but but I don't know how much detail you want to go, given the general major point of your work. So if you want personal histories, I can give you all of that.
Well, I do want to, a little personal history would be helpful, a little bit how, the connection from New York to Madison.
Right. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. So I'm a red diaper baby.
Uh-huh.
And I had, when I was quite young, a hero who's a man by the name of David Franklin.
Uh-huh.
One of several heroes, and he was a hero because he had been a student in Madison, and then he volunteered to join the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Right.
And I met him because he became the stepfather of a kid I went to school with.
Yeah.
Right. And so years later, when the opportunity to compete for the Ford scholarships came up.
Yeah.
I was connected to David in two ways. One, he was a biology teacher, not mine, but he lived in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so he mentored me as I prepared for the exams. But also, of the four schools that one could apply to, one was Columbia, one was Yale, I believe, and Chicago and Madison. I knew I wanted to go to Madison because he had been there and he had spoken so highly of it.
Huh. Did you know other people that were at Madison at the time?
No, absolutely not.
Oh, really? Okay. And so when you got to Madison, maybe you can explain a little bit what your expectations were going to college, right? You were interested in politics. Were you also thinking about career opportunities and those kind of things, or was that kind of in the background at the time?
That was in the background.
Yeah.
I was sort of on a track to be a doctor because of parental influence.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't pretend that I had deep thoughts about all of that.
Mostly politics was what interested you
right.
at the time.
And, politics in the early 50s and... So the summer before, that's the summer of 51,
mm-hmm.
so that's the beginning of the Korean War.
Right.
And then I spent the summer working as kitchen help and as part of the entertainment for a left-wing dude ranch in a little town called San Cristobal, New Mexico.
Really? All the way in New Mexico,
yeah.
huh?
Right, and so I spent the summer there, and
yeah.
that was just filled with left-wingers, obviously,
right.
and came back from that, and so I arrived at Madison. I'd never visited before,
right.
and so I, so help me, I was wearing a hat, a cowboy hat,
yeah.
and I wore a knife. Strapped to the outside of my thigh. I mean, this is, just ridiculous.
Right.
But, so this was very much very early teenage. Right.
Now, so you, how did you actually, once you arrived in Madison, that was the fall of 51, right?
Right.
When you actually arrived in Madison that year, that fall, how did you actually, find... the folks on campus that were, of like mind with you.
Right. So there's two ways in which I did that. One, the people who were looking after the new Ford Scholars put us together, and they decided that, well, how do you put people, into housing? They chose
right.
the housing. So they put, you know, the four New Yorkers into a boarding house together.
Right.
And so Arnie Lieber was one of my roommates.
Okay. So you didn't know him before you came to Madison?
No.
Okay.
No. And I think Marty Sklar was in that house as well.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't an immediate roommate, but was shifted around.
Right.
Right.
Right. So that was your quick introduction, huh?
Right. Right.
Okay.
And I don't know, I mean, other than looking for them, how I found the LYL
mm-hmm.
at the time. Now, because there were public people, of course.
Right.
Right, because of the way things were set up. And the public person was Alida Letwin.
Right.
Right.
She was the chairperson of the group or something like that. Okay.
And I was willing to go public, even though I was a freshman, and so that happened very quickly.
Now, why was there... So there were some members that were public members, and some members that were...
Two, because you had to have two people to be...
Registered.
...the organizational forms to be a campus organization.
And the rest of the members chose to keep their membership secret?
That was our policy.
Okay. Oh, so that was a group policy. That was not an individual choice.
Right, and that was a national policy, and that goes back to the Cold War and McCarthyism and so on.
Right,
so
right.
This was
okay.
Now, that plays a role, and perhaps the peculiar role that the league at Madison had during that period,
mm-hmm.
Because we began to break with that policy towards the end of my 4 years there. And that's important, but it doesn't enter into things right away.
Okay. So you actually spent full 4 years at Madison, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So you got
kicked out at one point, but they let me back in.
what kind of activities, what kind of issues were you and other members of the LYL and other groups. What really interested you, or you know, captured your imagination during these years?
Well, captured our imagination. That's an interesting phrase because I don't know if we actually looked at it. So there are certain things that stood out,
mm-hmm.
and so I went public with an article that I didn't write, but I signed, that
mm-hmm.
appeared in the Cardinal
mm-hmm.
in the fall of 51.
Mm-hmm.
And that dealt with racism in the context of the war then going on in Korea.
Yeah.
And in many ways, that's kind of interesting. Because... now I'm going to provide you with some post hoc analysis
sure.
and all of it.
Sure.
So we took on racism, you know, very upfront. So that was one of the major themes in that whole period. McCarthyism was the second one,
mm-hmm.
and some of the aspects of the Cold War a third. But in retrospect, my feeling is that what made us different from other organizations at the time was that vis-a-vis the Cold War, because we were defenders of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
that didn't interest us so much, the defense of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
But it had the effect of freeing us from the obligation to attack it.
Okay.
And the additional obligation then of backing the U.S. Vis-a-vis the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So we could go on and talk about racism as being U.S. policy
mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have to worry about the negative consequences of saying that.
Right.
And that was liberating.
Yeah. And you were also a member of the NAACP, the campus?
Yep. Yep.
And that was connected to your interest in racism?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Now, did you make the... So did you see racism in kind of the context of the Cold War then? As this is a critique of the United States and capitalism.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we felt it was absolutely embedded in the American way of life and institutionalized. Absolutely.
Okay.
Right.
You mentioned that there wasn't a lot. You didn't spend a lot of time defending the Soviet Union then.
Right.
That so, was.
Yes. We did in certain prominent ways.
Right.
We weren't, as the old left was, we weren't, you know, connected with that defense as being a necessary part of our existence.
Right. So you didn't consider yourself part of the old left then?
No, absolutely not. So we were connected to, you know, the Soviet Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
We were connected to the party. I was a member of the party,
mm-hmm.
though that wasn't publicly known.
Yeah.
Right. We had a couple of people who were older. You know, we were a bunch of 16 and 17-year-olds, you know, out in Madison.
Right.
And we ran the show.
Right.
I mean...
Pretty exciting.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Right. Now, what did you do for fun? So being part of this organization was fun, it was exciting, it was all those things.
Right. But day to day, it was mundane.
Right.
We were caught up with the secrecy and... even when I got kicked out 3 years later, there wasn't a sense of dire consequences.
Right. You got kicked out of the university?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that didn't come until my junior year.
Yeah. Well, that's really interesting that you mentioned that, you know, you felt kind of distinct from the old left, because usually the... You know, having done a lot of reading on this period, you know, the break is usually maybe the late 50s or the early 60s, where people kind of make that break, and most people would place the Labor Youth League squarely in the old left, but you felt that there was a distinction,
right? And we knew that,
yeah.
And it came out in small ways. So the particular way I remember that, and it has to do with a. isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, was that there was, and this is probably junior year, there was going to be the opportunity for an exchange between the U.S. and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And for some arcane reason that I can't remember, the Soviet Union backed out of it, you
mm-hmm.
know, because I think the visitors would have to be fingerprinted or something like that.
Okay.
And, you know, and we thought that was absolutely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that there was a real chance for a breakthrough and to, quote, hold to principle, you know, was ridiculous. And we had to write a piece about the whole struggle for the new foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrote it up as we saw it, but when the article appeared and we got copies from the National to distribute, our take on it was changed.
Really?
And we refused to distribute that issue.
This was the a newspaper that was associated with the Communist Party?
Yeah, it was
Party?
A magazine.
Oh, okay,
right,
a magazine.
New Foundation.
Okay.
Right. And we just said, you know, we're not going to distribute it. That's
right.
True.
Right.
And what could they do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So you mentioned your isolation. You meant your isolation from the East Coast.
That's right.
Or from the West Coast.
Right. Well, West Coast we didn't even think about.
Right. That was too far.
Right. Yeah.
But from New York City and, okay.
Right. So people would come and visit and, quote, provide direction.
Yeah.
And these would be maybe twice a year visits. And we consider them important. But I can't remember, you know, critical directives coming down from the top in a meaningful way.
Right. What other groups were you a part of? So the League, the NAACP, were there other...
me personally?
Yeah,
or other people?
You personally.
I can't, you know, one semester or several semesters I was a member of the Green Lantern Co-op.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, were other people in the League involved in other groups then?
Yeah, many.
Okay.
And there are organizations that still, and people who still haven't been mentioned publicly
mm-hmm.
that were much more far-reaching than lots of people knew.
Really?
Yeah.
So there was a wide degree of activity going on.
Right. So there was some... There was leadership of some of the religious groups on campus who were secret League members.
Mm-hmm.
and there were people in student government who were secret league members.
Mm-hmm.
And I still haven't seen those names publicly yet.
Okay. By the way, I should ask you, how big was the league? I've seen all kinds of numbers. Mm-hmm. Generally, you know, 10 to 20 to 25, something like that. Does that sound about right?
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
So somewhere in that ballpark.
Yep.
Okay.
But numbers were increasing as year by year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So your 4 years there, the group actually got larger, huh?
What? That had to do with the fact that we began to go public,
uh-huh.
which was unheard of.
Now, why did you begin to go public?
Well, because my girlfriend of that period, Jackie Cronick, simply said, "This is ridiculous." You know, and she was a free spirit. And then people who in my senior year were my landlords, Saul and Nina, they thought, you know, why not? I mean, it was you just couldn't get things done if there was no real public space.
Right. What kind of things did you try and do?
Well, the open forum. And again, that's important in this whole context because there were people there who treated us, whatever they thought of our politics, mm-hmm. but they treated us like as if we were part of the whole spectrum.
Right.
We were not pariahs. So that was important. And that includes people like Dick Schickel,
mm-hmm.
Even though he's written about us as if we were notorious and evil individually of that time. His behavior at the time was different. That is that the particular incident that I remember is this. We had a booth set up. There was always a time when organizations could put up booths early in the year so that freshmen could, you know, join up or whatever.
Right, right.
And this was held in the student union. And for some reason, what would have to have been Arnie and me, you know, being the people at the booth, we had to both be away for a while.
Yeah.
And Dick was sitting nearby, and we asked him to mind the booth, and he sat behind the booth for a while.
Really?
Right.
Wasn't afraid to do that.
He wasn't afraid to do that. That's, you know, and I'm not trying to say that he was, you know, that he supported us in any way.
Right.
Clearly, he didn't. Absolutely not. But he wasn't afraid to do that.
Yeah.
And that was important. Right. And then, again, this is senior year, when Bertel, you know, was willing to debate us,
uh-huh.
that was a break with, you know, what the Trotskyists of the time, you know, would do.
Right.
And so that's, you know, more power to them.
Yeah. How did you... So it was impressive that at least some on the campus were willing to accept you as part of the political dialogue.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, did you feel that some people weren't willing to accept you?
Yeah, but, you know, they, at least personally, you know, the unpleasant incidents were, you know, were few and far between.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, even in ROTC, right,
mm-hmm.
Which I had to, you know, take part of.
Right.
I, you know, the Major Bozeman, you know, who, as far as I remember, he was in charge of transport at the Incheon Landing in Korea.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's in my memory. But he was our ROTC officer.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, he encouraged people in my company to pay for a haircut for me so that I wouldn't disgrace the group when I paraded on Armed Forces Day. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. Right. But, you know, right. So
now what about the administration? I mean, there's this kind of often repeated commitment to free speech and academic freedom,
right.
and the like. Did that seem to...
That was real.
That was a genuine commitment.
That was a genuine commitment. Yeah, so I got kicked out for cutting classes in my junior year.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt that I was. Partly that was because I'd gone off to New York in a very public way and testified at the Subversive Activities Control Board.
Right.
Right. But you know, they, you know, I got kicked out, and then I appealed at the beginning of the next semester to be allowed back in.
Yeah.
And my mother came. I cried, you know. But, and they let me back in. Now, they didn't have to do that.
Right. It would have been very easy for them not to have.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they were under enormous pressure not to.
Right.
And they went and did it.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty remarkable. So did Madison seem to stand out to you? I don't know what you were in touch with people at other universities at the time or friends back in New York maybe?
I don't remember doing a lot of comparison, but we knew we certainly knew we were unique.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you rarely felt harassed because of your politics?
Very, very rarely. Mm-hmm. Once I remember giving out leaflets and some guy came by and knocked all the leaflets into the street.
Yeah.
Right. But that was, you know, pretty minimal.
Yeah.
And by the senior, junior and senior year, we would have public speakers, Joe Starobin, I remember in particular,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, but there were others, you know, and we got people coming out by the hundreds and
right.
hundreds to see them.
Yeah.
So that was the public face, and was very successful in the sense that, you know, people came and it was a dialogue.
Now, what do you credit that to? Why? Because that seems like kind of an exception, and maybe.
Well, again, there's the official Madison, you know, the University of Wisconsin attitude,
mm-hmm.
right? they permitted it, but
yeah.
then there was the fact that what we were doing was, you know, doing what 17 and 18 year old boys were doing.
Yeah.
Right, there's a funny way in which I credit our enthusiasm. But people had to be willing.
Right.
And that's why I mentioned Schickel and Ullman. But there were others.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was, maybe it was condescending. They thought that we could be weaned away from it because God knows we weren't hard-bitten Marxists.
Right.
We could barely spell it.
So you did things like invite speakers to campus, leaflets, the booths, and in the union and elsewhere.
Right.
Were there other kinds of activities you did? You wrote things for the Daily Cardinal.
The Cardinal.
Yeah.
Right. There's one ad which which we announced ourselves publicly. You've
yeah.
probably seen that.
Uh huh.
Have you?
I believe so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've read through all those Cardinals from those
right,
years.
Right. But that was the one that. You know, we're like everyone else, except we believe in Marxism, Leninism, that is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Dialectical material. You know, but it was that tone. You know, the actual breakthrough activities did come years later.
Yeah.
And that was the anti-military ball and things like that.
Right.
But we weren't able to go that far.
Right. How did you feel at the time that you were having any success in achieving, you know, the goals that you set out for yourself, or did you feel discouraged?
To measure success,
yeah.
The departure of McCarthy was important, but
right.
we didn't credit ourselves for that at all.
Yeah.
But we felt that we were part of that. The Green Feather Movement, we felt we were part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the developing awareness of colonialism, anti-colonialism, the connections with what we would now call third world people on campus.
Mm-hmm.
We felt we were part of a winning international movement. So you know, what was going on in China, we connected with all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, there were a few things in which, very few things in which we could see our hand directly
mm-hmm.
In a public way. So, we did a housing survey, basically, in which we called up people who rented to students and identified ourselves basically as white or black and would get different answers as to the availability of rooms.
Right.
And we revealed all that.
Yeah.
So we were publicly connected with that.
Yeah.
There weren't major things. I mean, who knows what resolutions were being passed by student governments and,
right.
you know, other organizations, which, you know, we would help to organize, and I don't have specific memory of those.
Right. What do you think, you know, you were active politically, and yet that generation that you were a part of has, you know, oftentimes been called this, you know, so-called silent generation.
Right.
Does that obviously doesn't kind of make that much sense in your case, right?
Right, but you know, there was the element of the New York Jewish Communists, which was, you know, one part, and I don't think that we were able to make meaningful connections with, you know, the average kid from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You know, the things that we would do, which was say, you know, people should live in the Y because that would give them contact.
Yeah.
Or, you know, live in the dorms. You know, people would do that. But the idea that they were able to break the cultural barriers, or that we were even aware of how big a role those cultural barriers played, I think we were unaware.
Yeah.
And it took people, you know, people who are much more in touch than I was with lots of people like Saul and Nina or my girlfriend Jackie, you know, to realize what that cultural gulf meant.
Yeah. So you had a hard time connecting outside of the circle of kind of New York Jews.
Right, but again, some of the secret members were not New York Jews.
Yeah.
And the fact that they were able to remain secret was precisely because they didn't hang in those cultural circles.
Right, right. How were New York Jews kind of accepted on campus? I know that there was some kind of, you know, I don't know, there was a lot of things in the newspaper and controversy over
right.
out-of-state tuition and all kinds of things.
Right, right. So I remember only one incident which is connected with that.
Yeah.
And it concerns a guy who may have been the current leadership of the Young Dems on campus, so played some leadership role. I remember his name is Chuck, but I'm not absolutely sure. There was a spring rainstorm,
mm-hmm.
one of the big shower, you know, rainstorms, and dashed into the doorway of the what used to be a pharmacy drugstore on the corner of University and Park, I think,
mm-hmm.
And just out of the rain. And this guy also dashes in and is standing next to me. And we're not talking to one another. We're just sort of staring out the rain.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he turns to me and says, you know, Wirtis, it's people like you who give all New York Jews a bad reputation. And I didn't know what to say. You know,
so he was another New York Jew?
Yes, yes. And there was a long pause, and then he said, and you don't even look Jewish. So I was aware of how he was responding
right.
to all of that.
Right, right.
You know, I don't remember specific at all any incidents of anti-Semitism in
mm-hmm.
any personal way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, you know, so I didn't feel it. And again, it just may have been my, you know,
was there
inability to recognize this stuff.
Did you, if you didn't feel it personally, did you feel it against, you know, against the league as a group?
No.
No.
No. No. I felt that that was all ideological.
Yeah.
No, I may have been wrong, but that's what I felt.
Yeah. 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 What do you make of the, you know, the contrast that's often drawn between the 1950s and 1960s? I mean, you mentioned something about other people that maybe came along and were able to bridge this divide.
Mm-hmm.
Between kind of the small, relatively small group of, you know, mostly New York Jews, but not exclusively, and the broader kind of average Wisconsin student. Is that one of the things that kind of started to happen in the late 50s or early 60s?
Well, again, I'll go back to those people who sort of bridged my time there to the 60s. So these were people who were willing to step into that cultural divide.
Yeah.
We're open to things that would attract across that.
What kind of things were they willing to do, or were they doing? People like Saul or Nina.
Yeah. So again, that would be, but it's in the realm of almost popular culture. So the fact that they would think of an anti-military ball,
mm-hmm.
right? That's the sort of thing.
Okay.
Right.
So that, as opposed to the more kind of ideological or...
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see what you mean.
And the Green Feather Movement.
Yeah. Now, that was the kind of Robin Hood movement?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of anti-McCarthy stuff, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Who are some of the individuals that... either students or faculty members. We haven't talked at all about any of your faculty members, or if those played any role in your, other than kind of an academic role.
Well, the one that was important to me was a faculty person who was the advisor to the NAACP.
Okay.
And was also a geneticist, which is an area that I became interested in. And that was a guy with the improbable name of Jim Crow.
Right.
Yeah. Accepted me in a straightforward way.
Was he your advisor? Or just the advisor of the group?
I worked for him in his Drosophila lab for a bit. I didn't do a good job.
Yeah.
But he was just very forgiving.
Yeah. And again,
accepted me in this role in the NAACP, in the league, mm-hmm. in the lab. Right.
And how about other students? Arnie Lieber was one of your friends.
Right.
And there were.
He was my closest friend at the time.
Yeah, and there were others like Marty Sklar. Was
right.
Was Marty there before you, or
no,
about
no,
the same
exactly
time?
Exactly the same time.
And he came as
stayed on after.
He came as an undergrad Jew and then stayed as a graduate student, right?
Yeah, and they were roommates, right? But then they were non-league roommates. So that goes back to one of your earlier questions. So there were two, and they were important. One was a guy by the name of Tom Hartson,
mm-hmm.
and he was tall, blonde, from Michigan.
Yeah.
We were roommates, and he wasn't in the league, wasn't in the least bit interested. And then a guy who was a couple of years older, a guy by the name of Ted Cloak, and he, I think he must have been from Wisconsin. He drove a cab as well as was in school.
Yeah.
But the fact that he was older was very important. Yeah.
What kind of things did you do, and you and your friends do, in terms of social activities?
There was.
What kind of music did you listen to at the time?
I remember the beginning of rock and roll. So Rock Around the Clock. So we were into that from the beginning, but the tradition for me as a Red Dye the Baby was folk music.
Right.
And so I got into what we now call top 40s, during that time. But rock and roll was, more in tune with.
Yeah. Let me change the subject a little bit.
Yeah.
To the.
But one thing. So we definitely weren't into dope at the time.
Right. That wasn't, were you even...
I'm sure it was around.
Yeah.
Right? But zero awareness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a big contrast between your generation and...
That's right.
10 years later
but
15 years later.
But where that dividing line for that group of people was crossed, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about the, I mentioned that I'm... part of my, or my project kind of centers at least somewhat around this idea of the Cold War.
Right.
And one of the things I'm thinking about are things like civil defense, ROTC, the Korean War, the draft,
right,
those kinds of issues, and whether those played any role in students' lives or what kind of role they played in students' lives.
Right. So, again, I was talking about Korean War early.
Right.
So we opposed the Korean War. We saw the South as as a tool of the United States as having started it.
Yeah.
But our context was more of dealing with the racism that was involved at the time.
Right.
And so that was the way I remember we dealt with it mainly.
Okay.
The civil defense, I don't remember that.
I've never found any evidence that there were drills or anything along those, you know, civil defense drills.
No.
Okay. I didn't think so. What about the draft? Were you, now you came to Madison, you were a little younger than the traditional student.
Yes.
So you weren't subject to the draft initially.
Right.
But eventually you were.
Not until I was, until after graduation.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
So that wasn't an issue for you?
No. And I don't, I don't have memory of our proselytizing about it.
Yeah. I guess the draft was pretty selective at that time, and most college students managed to, one way or another, gain an exemption.
Right.
From what I understand.
Right.
So some were drafted, but most were not.
Right.
Would you say that your views after, while at the UW changed a good deal, or were you pretty much came out as you came in?
Well, the biggest thing that I think I came away with was a feeling that while I still love New York, still thought of it, and you know, it's the greatest place, but I didn't have patience anymore with people who wanted to dismiss the Midwest.
Yeah.
Or dismiss mainstream America.
Yeah.
What
kind of an appreciation did you gain then for, you know, the Midwest or mainstream America? What
right, that is that you have to really connect with it. You can't assume that people are stupid, naive, or anything like that.
And that's because you would run into people that weren't stupid?
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you go back to New York after you graduated?
Yeah, went back to New York. I worked for a year because I had to make up credits by correspondence because I'd been kicked out of school. And then I went to medical school. And the medical school was because of bad advice from Communist Party people.
Yeah.
Because the notion, I wanted to do research and get a PhD. And the argument was that I would never get a job.
Yeah.
With a PhD, but if I had an MD, I would be able to stay in science even if I couldn't get a job.
And they were wrong, huh?
They were wrong.
Yeah.
But done.
Yeah. So what else, I don't know, are there other things that have come to mind while we've been talking that, I don't know, I've kind of run through the main questions I have, but oftentimes I miss things, so.
No. What was probably significant, going back to one of your earlier questions, that was just beginning, was the reexamination of history and American political history.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who were involved in that, people like Sklar and eventually Landau, and you know, many more who eventually coalesced around studies on the left. That was going on in the background, and I wasn't part of that.
Yeah.
You know, I was interested in biology, and that was not something that I had expertise or immediate interest in.
Yeah.
And you know, the person who in our circle really drove that was Marty Sklar.
Yeah.
He just had the ability to shake things up in big ways.
Yeah.
Even though he could never finish writing any of them down.
Oh, where did you guys meet, by the way? Did you meet in people's homes or on campus somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you did meet regularly?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, constantly.
Yeah.
Norman Foster's later famous phrase, the revolution is a 24-hour meeting.
Now, Alida Letwin was one of the few. Now, were there a number of women in the group as well?
Oh, yeah.
There were.
Oh, absolutely.
Alida Letwin was maybe the only one to take, you know, kind of a public leadership position.
That's right.
Yeah. And that didn't seem unusual or problematic or anything. That seemed perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. That's fantastic. Lots of good information.
Okay. And if you want to follow up on other things, if you want me to rack my memory about specific things, happy to do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, oftentimes it's been a while, so, you know, those specific memories tend to fade, I know.
No kidding.
Kind of impressions stay and other things. Yeah, well, I will definitely, sometimes when I go back and listen to it again, I realize that, oh, I should have asked that question, or
yep.
I should have pushed more on this, or something along those lines. And like I said, I will provide, I'll type this up, you know, type up our conversation in the next week or two, and if you'd like, I'll just email it to you.
Whatever's helpful.
Yeah. Okay. And if you're interested, you can look over it or not. It's totally up to you.
I'm happy to do that.
Okay. Okay, well, thanks again for finding some time for me.
No problem.
I really appreciate it.
Okay. Have fun.
Thanks, and have a good afternoon.
Yeah.
Bye, Henry.